Hello and welcome to History by Hollywood, a podcast series that examines the real events and people behind fact-based movies. This is supplementary episode 1, Music in the Movies, for Sunday the 2nd of July 2017. My name is Martin Darlington, and I'm afraid that's it for this week. I'm flying solo. Before we go any further, errata and updates. Alert listener Jacob Morrison noticed that we failed to give any marks for Pocahontas in the last episode. Privately replying to Jacob, I said 5 to 6 for entertainment if you're under 10, and 3 for history, or was it 2, which is really based on getting some names correct. I hope Andrew will approve of my marking, and I'm sure in the next episode we'll get Andrew's thoughts on that. Listener feedback, we also had a long and really good email from Peter Hull. Thank you, Peter. He listed a host of films we could consider covering. Some of them we already had on a long list, but there were several really good suggestions that Peter came up with, so thank you very much indeed for that. And if anybody else has films that we haven't mentioned you think would make a good subject matter for us, please do write in hosts@historybyhollywood.com. It will get to us. We also, I have not been able to check the international iTunes review bank, so if anybody has done a review, please bear with us and we'll sweep you up and give you a thank you next time out. And now, on with the show. So, what is it exactly we're looking at with music in the movies? Well, as anyone who watches films will be aware, music plays an integral part in telling any story. It's very rare to find a film that doesn't use some form of score, either original music written for the film, or, as we'll have a look at through today's show, some films will use existing songs, either popular songs or classical music, and these are used to engender mood, to inform, and what we're going to look at today is also how they're used to manipulate our sympathies and our emotions. And hopefully we can, open eyes and minds slightly towards the almost the tricks that are played on us to guide our sympathies or our decisions or our interpretation of something that we're being shown visually. With the music, it adds an extra layer and it helps guide us in the direction that the filmmakers want us to go. So, to start off with, we heard an introduction which was from Lonesome Dove. This was a very, very good, in my opinion, miniseries based on Larry McMurtry's book of the same name. And the lead characters are played by Robert Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones, and they're two aging ex-Texas Rangers who decide to drive some cattle from Texas up to Montana in the late 1800s. The music I found very much along the same sort of genre as, say, The Magnificent Seven, and you know that some of these themes that we associate with films become so iconic. They almost take on a life of their own. So what we're going to listen to now is a few clips just blended together of some of the most iconic music of the last few decades.
Thank you.
So there we had The Magnificent Seven from the 60s, Gone with the Wind from the late 30s, Star Wars, originally from the 70s, but now obviously still going, the films with that incredible music by John Williams. And finally was The Fellowship of the Ring, which is 16 years old, would you believe? The first of the Lord of the Rings films, directed by Peter Jackson. But apart from these themes that we'll hear in adverts and ringtones and various other genres of media, music can also be used to tell a story. It can be used to set a scene or to give us a guide as to what sort of thing we can expect next. You don't have to have seen the film to understand that what you're going to hear next means get out of the water. Of course, the Jaws theme by John Williams, again, one of the most prolific and talented composers of film music, a long collaborator with Steven Spielberg, Jaws, of course, being one of his, and many other directors, a real master, one of the very few right at the top, along with, in modern days, probably Thomas Newman and Hans Zimmer. For me, I think Vangelis was incredibly talented when it came to writing music for movies. Sadly underused, but yeah, there have been many, and I know I'm missing out several, but we'll get to some as we go along. The other thing that telling the story can do is it can change a mood. It can set a scene and then show you how that mood can change on an event either happening in the film. And having just mentioned Vangelis, this next clip you're going to hear is from The Conquest of Paradise, the 1492, the film about Christopher Columbus, which we will come back and examine, hopefully with Vincent Schilling again, who's also written a piece about Columbus and some of the myths surrounding him, the man. But for this, I just want you to listen to the music. And just think about what sort of scene is conjured up by the first part and then the second part. Now, to me, the first bit is grey, quite dour. It speaks of toil and grimness. And then it's like the sun bursting through the clouds. And obviously, I've seen the film, so I'm probably dealing with some association. And, you know, if you're sat there thinking, no, that made me think of chips and gravy, I'm probably the only one. In which case, you might have switched off already. But I think you can get the idea. You know, the way that people can change a particular song or a tune in a movie to tell you, oh, something's happening, something's getting better, something's getting worse, something's getting dangerous. We can, of course, also be spoon-fed. And, even though when it came out in the early 80s or mid-80s, I really enjoyed the film, and it's got some great cinematography, and it's given all aviators some really, really funny naff one-liners. I'm going to use Top Gun's example here. So first of all, we're going to hear a very brief clip, and I think you'll be able to tell what sort of thing is going on. So there's some kind of motion, there's possibly some danger, something thrilling, and but definitely something's about to start or has started, which has motion, speed, action. Okay, let's see what we think's happening in the next clip. Yep, something sad has just happened. In this case, of course, it was the death of Goose, Maverick's best buddy. And let's see what we think's happening next. Okay, I'm being a bit mean and sort of gently taking the mickey out of Top Gun. But you can see what we mean. It's kind of a little bit two-dimensional, spoon-fed. It's almost a little bit like canned laughter in a comedy, you know, informing the audience where and when it is we're meant to laugh. At the time, watching it, you don't really consider it, and it just goes with it. And it is a, you know, the anthem or the main theme is a great bit of Van Halen guitaring, and it's a tune that I quite like listening to. But, you know, the message that it shows you through there is kind of playing with your emotions a bit. The final one I want to do, I want to cover in telling the story is quite an interesting one. This is from Friday the 13th, the original horror film. I mean, it's sort of slash fest or torture porn, as I believe they call it these days. The composer was a chap called Harry Manfredini, and he and the director got together and they decided they would only use music when the killer was on screen or at least present. So there were lots of scenes. There were romantic scenes, there were funny scenes, quite dramatic ones. There's one, Harry Manfredini himself said, there's one where they're setting up an archery butt, and one of the guys, one of the students at this summer camp they're trying to reopen, fires an arrow and just misses a girl. He said, now normally you'd expect there to be music with that, to tell you this is shocking, surprising, the anger, the comedy, whatever. And there's nothing. That the only times you hear the music is when the killer's there, and it's kind of pretty creepy music. So that's telling the story. Music, though, can tell us an awful lot more, and location can be one. I've thought about this quite a lot whilst Andrew and I have been planning this supplementary, and I don't know what it is that makes a particular sound familiar to a particular place or associated with a particular place. But if you'd never seen The Godfather, would the music you're about to hear still have you thinking of a dusty village in Sicily, or maybe a few old Italian-American men drinking coffee and smoking at a table outside a cafe in New Jersey? Or have I just watched The Sopranos too much? But do you know what I mean? Listen to this and think, does this say Italian? Or is it just that we associate this with The Godfather? You let us know or have a think about it. The next one is going back to Lonesome Dove. Now, this will probably be less known music and a less known, film. It's a television show or miniseries. But if I'd said, okay, this is a couple of cowboys, or I'd said this is an American film set in the 1800s, I'd like you to guess what kind of film it is, and I'd played you the opening clip, I'm going to make a fairly good guess due to its similarities to Magnificent Seven, High Chaparral, and that sort of music, that a lot of people would say, yeah, it's probably a Western. What you're going to hear now is the end of that clip blending into the next bit, and I can pretty much guarantee you're going to be able to tell me which part of the United States this is set in. Okay, did anyone have any answer other than near Mexico? No, I mean, it is set near the Rio Grande, and part of the early, or the first episode is the Robert Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones characters ride across the Rio Grande and go and steal some cattle from a Mexican neighbor and rival of theirs. But you see my point. So simply by a style of music, it immediately sets a scene and a location. Here's another example, which is very well known. So we immediately know we're talking somewhere like Kentucky or Tennessee or Arkansas, as I like to say, just to annoy Americans, sorry, Arkansas. You know, it's hillbilly country, you know. There's now the next one's not actually from a film. It's the opening chords of a 70s sort of punk, pop punk band who did a song. But again, you can guess immediately what the song's about or what country the song is about just by these opening chords. And I haven't quite worked out how or why, but it seems to work. The band was called The Vapors, and the song was Turning Japanese. You know, as soon as you hear that, you just think, well, that's Japanese. It didn't even have to use a big gong, although that could more be associated with Chinese, I suppose. And just to hammer home the point, and because it is a beautiful piece of music, let's see if anyone can guess which country, or in this case, city, is being referred to by the next piece of music. So that was the main theme music from a film called Is Paris Burning? It's not actually a film I've seen, but anyway, that's the piece of music. So, we've established that music can tell us a location, a nationality, a style, the dueling banjos with, okay, this is sort of, you know, redneck hillbilly country, or the Lonesome Dove thing with the sort of American cowboy theme blended into the Mexican theme. And what would we do if there was no music? Because real life doesn't have a soundtrack. I mean, okay, we listen to radios in our cars, we have headphones in. But if we were to watch a documentary, now often documentaries will have music overlays. But again, that's just to increase the drama. Now, we mentioned earlier Friday the 13th and the fact that they only used music when the killer was present, even if we couldn't actually see them or the characters couldn't see the killer. We knew the killer was present because the music was playing. I'm almost tempted to go back and watch that. So watch that film again, just to sort of see what it's like to watch a film with no music. But we have got some examples here. What we're going to listen to next is Richard Burton, who, you know, love him or hate him, had an incredibly charismatic presence, and a really, really good voice, especially for things like Shakespeare. So we're going to listen to an excerpt of Shakespeare's Henry V giving the famous Band of Brothers speech on the day of Agincourt. First of all, Richard Burton, and it's a stage performance, so there's no music. It is from a record, so I do apologise. There is a bit of scratching, which is quite atmospheric if you like vinyl. Straight after that, we're going to hear a different version, and it's Kenneth Branagh, from his film in the, I think, late 80s he made, or early 90s, Henry V. But that has the score of Patrick Doyle, very, very accomplished composer, accompanying it. Just have a listen and see the difference between without and with.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks set forth with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Now, okay, maybe the delivery of Branner is a little bit more measured. It almost feels as if Richard Burton wanted to get out of the theatre as quickly as possible because he had a hot date with Liz Taylor at a pub. I don't know. But you see the point. The music adds a richness and a drama and a kind of majesty that just the voice alone, no matter how great that voice is to listen to, it just doesn't have. Interestingly, from Branner's Henry V, Patrick Doyle, later on, after the battle, the English soldiers are going around gathering up their wounded and stealing anything they can from the French and you know, basically clearing up the battlefield as best they can. And they start singing, I don't know if it is actually a hymn or a chant, but it's called Non Nobis Domine. And it sounds like monks singing, which is probably quite realistic. They may well have burst into a sort of devotional song, thanking God for their victory. I don't know. But then you listen to what happens when we get the orchestra coming in behind. And again, just the entire change of character that happens to what we're listening to. I'm very reluctant to try and take any enjoyment away from watching films that people may have, or from myself, because I have discovered that, especially if I watch anything with a slight historical bent, I start analysing it now. So I've probably ruined watching any historically based films for myself for the rest of my life. I blame Andrew. Anyway, what I want to look at now is another example of this, but in a very different sort of style. And again, such an iconic tune. It's gone down and has been referred to often now as Colonel Bogey. And this is, of course, the Bridge of the River Kwai, Alec Guinness's ramrod-backed British officer commanding his British POWs under the Japanese as they march into camp. But again, listen to the start of the clip, which is, if they any of our POWs actually did come in whistling, which I suspect they didn't, but anyway, if they did, that's what it would have sounded like, not what you get towards the end of the clip. That's for our benefit. Thank you. just to even the balance up and have a European theatre of World War II and an Axis power rather than just an Allied, here is Robert Shaw's Panzerkreuz in the Battle of the Bulge trying to demonstrate how ready they are to fight for him by singing their Panzer song. And exactly the same effect. You know, I'm just sticking this in because I can, really.
Obstürmt oder steigt um die Sonne und sagt, der Tag blühen heiß oder eiskalt die Nacht. Bestaubt sind die Gesichter, doch froh ist unser Sinn, ja, unser Sinn. Es braust unser Panzer im Schulbild dahin.
Incidentally, if anybody does watch Battle of the Bulge again, when it gets to that song and Robert Shaw turns around to his driver, I think whose name was Willy, and says, "Sing! Louder!" I don't think Willy knows the words. It's quite funny watching him. Anyway, enough of such things. The next bit I want to look at is really quite fascinating. I've only really discovered this whilst researching this supplementary episode, and it's the leitmotif. That's L-E-I-T-M-O-T-I-F, leitmotif. This is a technique where a particular tune is allocated to a single character, each character having their own tune. That tune may vary. It might be major key, minor key. It might be quite loud and martial, or it may be, you know, quiet and melancholy. But it's the same tune. Now, this is ascribed to Richard Wagner, the opera composer, the German opera composer, who used it in the Ring operas, where Siegfried would have his tune, and I'm trying to think, you know, Isolde would have her tune. And there are plenty of examples of this. And the first one I'm going to look at is, we're going back to John Williams and Star Wars, but it does give you an idea of another way in which a filmmaker, by the use of music, can inform us of whether this is a good person, a bad person, a jolly person, a sad person. So the first one we're going to hear is Luke Skywalker, then Princess Leia, and then, of course, the big bad baddie, Darth Vader. So there you go, that was Luke first, then Leia, and Luke's theme, incidentally, is also used as the theme for the Force itself when it's being mentioned or demonstrated, but when you listen to Darth Vader's at the end, the Imperial March, absolutely no doubt about who is meant to be the bad guy in all of this. Another very, very well-known tune, you'll all recognise this. This was written by Ennio Morricone, writing the music for one of Sergio Leone's spaghetti westerns, in this case, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But listen to it, and I'm only going to play you the one clip, but it's interesting how he differentiates the three characters, the good character, the bad character, and the ugly character. So here it is. So what Morricone did was, the three characters, Blondie, played by Clint Eastwood, Tuco, played by Eli Wallach, who of course also played the baddie, the bandit leader in The Magnificent Seven, and Angel Eyes, played by Lee Van Cleef, all three of them have the same tune, but it's played in a different way. So Clint Eastwood's character, Blondie, has a recorder followed by a wah-wah voice. Tuco has screams followed by a wah-wah voice. And Angel Eyes has a bass ocarina followed by an electric guitar. So it's almost like he's saying, okay, they all get the same tune because they're all really bad people, but they're different kinds of bad people. So we'll change the delivery of the same tune. Okay, here's another. Now, this is the theme of a film franchise, but it is also a leitmotif. Now, yeah, of course, it's James Bond and it's the theme of the movies. But if you hear that during the film, not just at the opening scene, it is often used as a vehicle to tell you, okay, he's about to get serious and obviously awesome and do lots of really dangerous stuff and win the day. But it is, it's like, okay, the joking's finished. This is where James Bond does what James Bond does. Now, let's go to a film which had a leitmotif for several characters. And this is a film that we covered in episode 9. This is Waterloo. This was the episode, the monster 2-hour-plus episode with Cameron Riley coming on board. Now, director Sergei Bondarchuk, together with Nino Rota, his Italian composer, gave some interesting themes to their protagonists. Now, I didn't think about this. I didn't really sort of notice it until, again, I was thinking about films we've reviewed and other films I've seen. For examples of this leitmotif, what we're going to do, I'm going to play you Napoleon's main theme. Now, this is played initially on his return from exile in Elba, but it does return during the Battle of Waterloo and at the end to represent, this is Napoleon. Now that is dramatic, yeah, but it's kind of tragic and dark. It's not really an uplifting tune. And even when Bondarchuk and his Rota, his composer, when you have the French soldiers marching, it's very harsh drums and a kind of thin reedy flute or fife playing in the background. So just have a listen to that. This is the French troops advancing at the Battle of Waterloo. And now let's compare that to the one tune most associated with Wellington, other than his arrival at the Duchess of Richmond's ball, which is a classical piece. This is an old British marching tune called Brighton Camp. But just listen to the delivery and think about what you've just heard with Napoleon and then the French marching. So when you listen to those three sort of back-to-back, I do believe that Sergei Bondarchuk is basically giving us a message of, yeah, you know, Napoleon magnificent, brilliant, but basically tragic, and you don't really want to be backing this guy. No, the chap you want is the one with the jolly little tune and the quip and the British aristocratic stiff upper lip, you know, and all the rest of it. So it's fascinating when you start to examine these things and think, yeah, I'm being led by the nose. And obviously, being British, I do believe that Wellington's a lovely chap and he is the one we should cheer for and all be happy. The next thing I want to move on to, and we're nearly done, don't worry, is where I've called in my notes to myself here, I've called this incongruous music, where it just kind of seems inappropriate or wrong or out of style, and yet somehow often it really works. Now, again, a lot of the films I'm using here are not at all factually based. And this is, I think, a modern director who does this very well. And it's using existing songs, pop songs, or existing music. And this is Quentin Tarantino. So the clip I'm going to play you is from Reservoir Dogs. You're going to hear Michael Madsen threatening Tim Roth. Tim Roth's tied to a chair. Michael Madsen's about to torture him. And the music they use kind of adds to the madness of the scene. Basically, Michael Madsen has said to Tim Roth, "I'm not going to torture you for information. I don't care what you know. I'm doing it because it amuses me." So this sort of reinforces the idea that this guy's a bit psychotic, particularly when he starts to sing along.
"All you can do is pray for a quick death, which you ain't gonna get."
"Hey, Billy, super sounds of the 70s continue." "Oh.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling of something right."
So you've got, as the radio DJ in that scene describes it, a bubblegum pop song, Steeler's Wheel, and Stuck in the Middle with You, which is incidentally gave rise to the best bit of truck graffiti I've ever seen. You know, when people write things in the dust on the back of a truck or a van, and this said had an arrow pointing to the left, and someone had written underneath "clowns" and an arrow pointing to the right, and they'd written "jokers." I just thought it was brilliant. Anyway, I digress, not for the first time. Okay, for anyone who's seen Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now, 1970s, very influential Vietnam film, slightly crazy, with a slightly bonkers Marlon Brando playing Colonel Kurtz. The main character is played by Martin Sheen. But there's one scene where he accompanies a American helicopter squadron in a gunship attack on a Vietnamese village. Their colonel is another slightly bonkers colonel called Robert Duval, who's obsessed with surfing. But one of the things they do is they play Wagner, Ride of the Valkyries, through loudspeakers. For people of my generation, I'm in my early 50s, this is probably what you would associate the Ride of the Valkyries with most, unless, of course, you remember the Parachute Regiment of the British Army, in which case it's your regimental march. But for the rest of us, this is kind of mad and incongruous, but again, kind of works. Ironically, the next clip is from an 80s, also iconic Vietnam film, Platoon, which the main character was Charlie Sheen, the son of Martin. Now, in this scene, Oliver Stone has done something I think quite clever. He's not a director I always think of as quite clever, although sometimes he can border on genius, but in this scene, we're going to hear a small clip from. It's one of the movie's most powerful scenes. Charlie Sheen's character is a young soldier, and his mentor, Sergeant Elias, played by Willem Dafoe, he's been left behind by the helicopters as they lift out, presumed dead. As it turns out, he's actually been shot by the Tom Berenger character as the senior sergeant, the squad sergeant, or the platoon sergeant. But we don't need to go into the politics of why he shot one of his own men. But as the helicopters lift out, they see Elias still alive, running, being pursued by Vietnamese troops, and then shot to death. And it's incredibly powerful. It's the slow motion elements to it, and it's guns being fired, Elias being hit repeatedly. Very dramatic, very tragic, very action ridden. And yet the music accompanying it is Samuel Barber's hauntingly beautiful Adagio for Strings. Again, totally incongruous, totally just mismatched, or it should be, and yet it's not, and it just gives a depth to the scene that is so powerful. And you're not going to get much of that, I'm afraid, just from this very short clip, but just to give you the example.
back down there!
And now to the final element I just want to look at, and this is really just for musicals. We've covered a couple, Sound of Music and Pocahontas. We have Evita on the list because Eva Perón is a fascinating character about which I, at this stage, know very little, so I'll have to do a lot of research. But musicals, obviously, can use music all the way through, and they can use it in many clever different ways. And the only example I really want to use here, we're going to have a little clip from West Side Story, and this is towards the culmination, the climax of the film, and you have the Jets and the Sharks, these two rival enemy gangs, and they're heading for a rumble. They're going to have a showdown with each other. At the same time, you have Tony, the main character, who is a former member of the Jets, and Maria, who is the other main character, and these are the Romeo and Juliet characters of West Side Story, if you don't know the story, and she is the sister of the leader of the Sharks. They're singing their bit, but we're not actually going to listen to that. But the point is, you have these two gangs singing the same song. I'll show you what I mean.
We're going to hand them a surprise tonight. We're going to cut them down to size tonight. We said, okay, no rumpus, no tricks. But just in case they jump us, we're ready to mix tonight. We're gonna rock it tonight. We're gonna jazz it up and have us a ball. They're gonna get it tonight. The more they turn it on, the harder they fall. Well, they began it. Well, they began it. And we're the ones to stop them once and for all tonight.
So you can see what Leonard Bernstein's done there with his lyrics is basically having the two gangs singing exactly the same song, yet they began it and we're going to stop it. And it kind of just shows the futility of conflict in this sort of environment. The final example I'm going to use is one that we did last time out, Pocahontas. And a song we didn't actually mention in our coverage is Savages. And this is when the nasty character Governor Ratcliffe is about to take the English settlers to attack the Powhatan Native Americans, and the Powhatans have decided the only thing they can do with the English settlers is attack them. And they both sing the same song about each other with slight variations. So here is our final clip.
Sure, they're not like you and me, which means they must be evil. We must stop the problems of war.
They're savages, savages,
dirty, shrieking devils.
Now we sound the drums of war.
This is what we feared. The pale face is a demon. The only thing they feel at all is greed. Beneath that milky hide, there's emptiness inside.
I wonder if they even bleed.
They're savages, savages.
Barely even human.
Savages, savages.
Killers at the core. They're different from us, which means they can't be trusted. We must sound the drums of war.
And there you go. Both sides condemning the others for being, well, others. So, hopefully, it was an amusing diversion from our usual format. And, I mean, just looking at that Pocahontas film, whatever the failings of the Disney version of her story, and there were many, some of the songs actually carried some pretty strong and thoughtful messages. So all we're saying, really, in all this thing about music is, of course, we want to immerse ourselves in great movies. That's why we watch them. But when you next find the hairs standing up on your arms, or you're brought to the edge of tears, or you feel a surge of affection for a character, remember it's quite likely that at least an element of what's brought you to that state is possibly the music or the scene augmented by music. It's powerful stuff. I'm going to make a list on the show notes in the next day or so on the website of I'm recording this on Saturday night to publish for Sunday morning. I'll make a list of each movie and the music that we played from it, whether original or an existing piece, just in case anybody wanted to track one of them down. There's some lovely music that appears in films, and it never gets released as like a single, but or a track. But normally you can track it down on a soundtrack album or CD if people still use CDs. Even that sounds out of date now. Right, the next episode is Amadeus, and it should occur in 2 weeks' time on July the 16th, Sunday. But now we need some outro music. So for a prize yet to be determined, because we're still trying to find someone who'll put our logo onto a mug without fearing being sued, but drop us a line. And somebody can win something one day if you can tell us which 1983 American comedy movie used this piece of music that we're going to go out to, which I've chosen because, of course, it's by Mozart. It's the overture from The Marriage of Figaro, and we'll be doing Amadeus next, so it seemed appropriate. So thank you very much for your time. Hope you've enjoyed it. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, we are History by H. Wood. Twitter, at History by H. Wood, because we couldn't fit History by Hollywood in. It's too long for a Twitter handle. Or on Facebook, we have a Facebook page, History by Hollywood. And of course, you can email either of us at historybyhollywood.com, either Andrew at historybyhollywood.com or Martin. Or if you want to get both of us, hosts at historybyhollywood.com. Thanks very much, and we'll speak to you again next time. Bye-bye.